Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a pleasure to say that we have an opportunity to speak in some length with a man who has been studying closely, analyzing assiduously, and commenting with great effect on one of the most important facets of the war for the free world today and for the foreseeable future. His name is Richard Fisher. He is the Senior Fellow on Asian Military Affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He has been working on the topic of Chinese military power with a degree of, well, skill and knowledge that is virtually unsurpassed in the United States today. He has worked with the Congressional U.S.-China Security and Economic Review Commission. He has reported for Jane's Defense Weekly. He has written several books. We'll talk more about those in due course. But he is our go-to guy on what the Chinese communists are up to and what it's likely to mean for us, at least in the military space. And by that, I mean broadly defined, asymmetric threats, space activities, and the like. And he's here to present, among other things, an assessment of what the Defense Intelligence Agency has recently reported on Chinese military power and Chinese power projection. Rick Fisher, it is so great to have you with us, and thank you for taking a little bit of time to talk with us about this important new two-set publication of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Tell us about it.
Frank, thank you again for having me on, and thank you for your kind comments. All that I can say is that I'm a dedicated student of the Chinese military threat. But that said, the Defense Intelligence Agency has recently released two major reports that are in a way unprecedented and respond to the desire of conservative China analysts, recommendations we've been making for close to 20 years. In fact, when the annual DIA Pentagon China Military Power Report was first envisioned back in the 1997 to 1998 timeframe, those in the Senate who came up with this idea hoped that the Pentagon would produce a report, an annual report on China, that looked just like the Soviet military report series of the Reagan administration, a report series that had been wildly successful, helped to promote a positive consensus about the threat that we faced, that essentially argued well and convinced both Democrats, Republicans, liberals, and conservatives that we faced a real threat and had to be serious in our defense and leadership to meet that threat. In the end, we succeeded.
My memory of that era is a little bit different than yours, Rick, but maybe that's because I was in the Reagan administration and I was watching a lot of Democrats who were not terribly helpful on that score. There were some, though. Unfortunately, their likes are not evident in the Democratic Party at the moment, people like my old boss, Henry Scoop Jackson. But your point is well taken. The documents that were produced on Soviet military power over the years of the Reagan administration were extraordinarily important, I think, to all of us working in that space. And so how close to that model do we finally now see the Pentagon reports becoming?
Well, I'd say it's risen from 25% to 85%. I mean, there's still a great deal of room for improvement. But really, for the first time, what the Pentagon has produced is a template for an illustrated volume full of pictures and charts as well as text on the PLA threat. And this is what the originators of the China Military Power Report in the late 1990s hoped that the Pentagon would have started producing way back then.
And why didn't they, Rick? I mean, this is an important observation. What was it that prevented this kind of basic educational tool from being brought to bear in support of our military expenditures, but more to the point, our threat understanding at the public level, not just at the leadership level?
Frank, I'd say the key argument that prevailed in the late Clinton, throughout the George W. Bush, and then the Obama administrations was that China did not represent a Soviet Cold War level threat to the United States, and therefore did not deserve a Soviet Cold War level of threat description as represented by the Soviet Military Power Report. Of course, this was an argument that could have been, that was countered in the 1990s and was a valid and growing argument that was made over the ensuing 20 years. But it's taken that long for President Trump to come along and finally decide that, yes, we need a China military power report that approaches that of the Soviet military power report. And the director of the DIA references the Soviet military power report in the introduction.
I don't mean to be argumentative, but just to tease this out a little further, I would bet that at least part of what was going on was not that they were lowballing the Chinese threat or even correctly describing it as relatively modest at the time, but they were under political direction that the Chinese are not our adversary. Whatever level of capability they have militarily, they are our partners in trade particularly, but also they're peacefully rising, and that's a good thing. And there's nothing to see here, folks, in other words, hence no need for a report of this kind. Would you credit that as all?
Frank, absolutely. I mean, I stated the principal main argument, but the arguments that you mentioned were all there as well. And of course, both in the Pentagon and the State Department and in all three of these administrations, there was an overwhelming desire to engage the People's Liberation Army in hopes that we could convince them to adopt a more peaceful approach to the world, something that has failed completely because it's not the PLA that makes decisions in China. It's the Communist Party. And if we devoted half the effort to PLA engagement to Communist Party engagement, well, we might be, you know, another two or three steps down the right road, whereas today we're no steps down any road with China in terms of convincing them.
We have to pause here for just a moment. Rick Fisher, we're going to be back with a second segment with him, I'm very pleased to say, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined again by Richard Fisher, a national treasure, as far as I'm concerned, the Asian Military Affairs Senior Fellow at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He is also the author among many periodical pieces of a terrific book, Chinese Military Power, Building for Regional and Global Reach. We're talking with Rick about his assessment of two important studies recently released by the Defense Intelligence Agency about, in the first instance, Chinese military power, the subject of his book, and the power projection capabilities of Communist China. And Rick, we have about 12 minutes here, and I want to do a whirlwind tour through the highlights of these two documents. Let's start with the state of Chinese military readiness and modernization, such that we face, I gather, increasingly now a peer competitor in a whole host of technologies and military capabilities. Is that right?
Indeed, Frank. The Chinese People's Liberation Army has grown from basically a backward force that couldn't even claim fourth generation levels of capabilities back in the late 1980s to a force that is fully fused with fourth generation capabilities across the board and is moving rapidly into fifth generation and rapidly developing sixth generation levels of military capability, and has developed a specific military service that will lead it into the sixth generation of military capability. And by that, I mean the exploitation of vast increases of computing capabilities combined with unknown levels of artificial intelligence capabilities, combined with vast database gathering and exploitation, combined with modern and great use of energy weapons to allow the PLA to win battles in space and in cyberspace. That's just a tease of what they're, the kind of capabilities they're aiming for in the next decade and beyond. But today, we face a fourth-generation force that has close to 1,000 fourth-generation combat aircraft, a Navy that is, in terms of actual numbers, larger than our own, equipped with over 2,000 vertical launching systems for ships, and is rapidly building nuclear-powered submarines to be able to go after our American nuclear ballistic missile submarines, and building power projection forces that will be able to protect Chinese interests globally as we move from the 2020s into the 2030s.
So, Rick, to put it in layman's language, the Chinese are seeking to compete with us in every facet of traditional military power, it seems, including building up a fleet of aircraft carriers, something we were encouraged to believe they wouldn't do, amassing an immense strategic nuclear arsenal and short-range missiles as well that are capable of reaching particularly targets that they're focused on at the moment, like Taiwan. But in addition, what you're saying, they are bringing to bear the investments they've been making in high technology, notably things like 5G, something we'll be talking about momentarily with Kevin Freeman, and artificial intelligence and data mining and surveillance technologies and the like, and space capabilities to really steal a march on us in important respects. Is that accurate?
Frank, I think we have to start emphasizing that the Chinese are not just competing with us. They are seeking to dominate the United States. And if you had a chance, which very few to almost none of us have had, to actually sit in on top-level Chinese military planning meetings, I would say dominating the United States has been the subject, the goal, for well over 30 years. And that's what they're investing in, and that's what is going to unfold over the 1920s if we don't wise up and start to defend ourselves.
And Rick, what has also apparently been very much part of the agenda for the Chinese? I mean, they think strategically, they think over, you know, well, some would argue centuries, maybe even millennia, about how to behave in a way that will advantage them, particularly in sort of fulfilling Sun Tzu's famous dictum that it is better to win without war than have to fight it. But what are they doing with respect to positioning themselves around the globe in strategic choke points, notably, and other key countries and continents, for that matter, far from, you know, Asia, that will bear very directly on the kind of advantages that they may be able to have in any future conflict with the United States?
Well, Frank, for the first time, these questions were addressed by a brand new Defense Intelligence Agency report on Chinese power projection ambitions. Again, responding to congressional leadership, congressional legislation, the DIA produced a report that outlines how China is combining its predatory economics to gather political networks around the world that are enabling Chinese military access to facilities and then bases around the world. For the first time, the Pentagon has focused on the idea that the Chinese military threat is not just against Taiwan or not just out there in Asia, but could become a global challenge for the United States. China seeks to threaten America's global economic and political interests.
So I guess the question is, in a net assessment kind of sense, Rick Fisher, is what is teeing up now, as you see it, not a capability that in 2030 or 2040 or maybe even 2025, but pretty much today, is good to go. Should the Chinese decide that, whether it's in response to a domestic crisis of confidence in the political leadership, or demographic problems or economic difficulties or whatever else might move them, that when we hear Chinese military leaders talking about the advisability of launching a surprise attack against the United States, that this is something that is at hand, potentially, given what you and the Defense Intelligence Agency are describing. Is that, again, an exaggeration, or am I putting words in your mouth, or do you think it's not quite that bad yet, but it's headed that way?
One aspect that both Defense Intelligence Agency reports do not address, and it's been a longstanding complaint of mine, is that they don't address the potential for direct Chinese and Russian strategic and even conventional military cooperation against American interests. I mean, back in 1968, 1969, the United States threatened the Russians with nuclear weapons because they wanted us to gang up and nuke the Chinese. That then pivoted into Kissinger's tilt to China. Today, the Chinese and the Russians may be discussing, may be planning how to tilt their nuclear forces against the United States, let's say to deter us from supporting Taiwan, supporting South Korea, Latvia, the Baltics, you name it. This is a danger that I believe exists today, and we simply don't have the nuclear forces and variety of nuclear forces to deter this kind of blackmail at all the levels that it can reach us, especially at the intermediate level and the tactical level, both in Asia and in Europe. This is a real danger we face today.
Well, and the question is that danger widely enough understood at the moment to precipitate the kind of both popular support and leadership initiative to correct the problems that you're describing, Rick Fisher, and problems most especially with respect to, our obsolescing nuclear deterrent forces? Again, if what you've suggested here is what I think you've said, we may well have the Chinese and Russians jointly checkmating what we might think we can do in response to direct challenges to our security, or certainly that of our friends and allies. That is a problem that really demands the most urgent attention, it seems to me, from, again, both policymakers and the public, does it not?
Well, this danger was never mentioned by the Obama administration, but there are indications that President Trump may actually understand this. He may have decided not to talk about it publicly in order to give it validity and strength. And he is certainly moving in a direction that might allow us to deter a combined Chinese-Russian threat, let's say a decade out. But he clearly is turning the ship of state. He is preparing us to confront China, and he is beginning to move the Pentagon into acquiring the kind of forces that we need right now, but that we might have by the mid-2020s in order to sufficiently deter the Chinese and the Russians and save Americans from having to march off to numerous wars.
Rick Fisher, thank you for the work you do, my friend, at the International Assessment and Strategy Center, and for your periodic visits with us. I hope you'll come back for a full hour soon. We really need an even deeper dive on these two reports and, of course, other developments that you're tracking closely. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by the man who takes us inside the economic war room. With regularity, I'm pleased to say he is Kevin Freeman, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, specializing in economic warfare. He is the host of a terrific new program at the Blaze TV. It is entitled Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. You can also find his writings at globaleconomicwarfare.com and, of course, his two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. Kevin, it's good to have you back. Always a very full plate when you're around. I'm glad to have you with us to walk through some of the challenges that we're facing at the moment.
Thanks, Frank. It's good to be here.
Well, specifically, the challenge posed by Huawei is on my mind, as I think it is yours and a lot of us in the national security and economic warfare space. Kevin, remind us a little bit about the company. We talk about it a lot with you and others, but just sort of to level set, who are these guys? Who do they work for, or at least with? And what are the implications of our relying upon their products as a country, as individuals for that matter?
Well, Huawei is one of the largest technology companies in the world. They're the number two supplier of mobile phones. They've passed Apple in size. They're a Chinese company. They offer, by all accounts, very sophisticated, cutting-edge technology. The question is, how have they gotten to this point? Their founding does not come from a technologist. Their founding comes from a former member of the People's Liberation Army in China. And as we know, almost you cannot operate a major company in China without government or military approval, and the Huawei seems to have both. And they are potentially, many claim, and the Pentagon has suggested, a backdoor for China to reach into the technology of other nations around the world. They're active in 5G, which we've talked about a lot. They're active in behind the scenes IT supply chain stuff that puts them in a unique position to literally steal secrets, not only from themselves, but for the Chinese government. And so they're a very serious potential threat to the world.
And you've studied these guys. Is there any doubt in your mind that despite protestations that they are expressing now, I guess, on a sort of global apology tour, that they actually are joined at the hip or at some body part, at least, with the People's Liberation Army, its intelligence services, the Chinese Communist Party, or other organs of the state?
Well, now that's the interesting part, because the CEO is out. Number one, he came out last week and said, we are not an arm of the Chinese government. We would not turn over information automatically to the Chinese government, which is ludicrous. Our own companies operating in China are being forced to turn over information. It's funny, the contrast between Tim Cook from Apple, who goes into China and actually says, oh, we support what you're doing here, and the Huawei CEO, who comes outside of China and says, we don't do anything the government tells us, we're completely independent. I mean, it's literally a joke. The lady doth protest too much. Now this week, he's warning that there may be serious job losses, and the company is going to axe mediocre employees who might be somehow connected with the Chinese government. You know, they're literally trying to cover up something they've been caught red-handed in.
Well, this brings us to the case of, I guess it's his daughter, who is currently being held by Canadian authorities at the request of the United States government, which has just, I guess today, announced that it wishes to have her extradited to the United States. This is the chief financial officer of Huawei, and widely expected to be its future head. She obviously knows where a lot of bodies are buried in that outfit, I assume, Kevin Freeman. And what would it mean were she to be subjected to, shall we say, interrogation by U.S. authorities about the activities of her company and her knowledge of them?
Well, she's the daughter of the founder. She is the CFO. She's intimately tied to both the military and the Communist Party. She does know enormous amount of things regarding Huawei's activities around the world. I suspect that one of the reasons that we're seeing some cooperation, for example, Germany saying that they don't want to move forward with Huawei and other countries working with us, particularly Canada, is evidence that she has the goods and we know what they are, and we're going to press and get them from them. By the way, we had Fred Flights in the Economic War Room, your colleague, this past week. It's currently the show that we have up. And Fred pointed out, you know, a lot of people question the Trump administration and say, well, he's ruining our reputation. Well, for the Chinese to have arrested her, this Huawei CFO, and held her at our request.
The Canadian government, you're saying?
Yeah, the Canadian government to arrest this Chinese woman actually shows how effective the Trump administration is in certain areas. And this is one of them. And Fred made that point very strongly.
Well, it's all the more interesting because there have been lots of difficulties between particularly President Trump and the Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau. But more to the point, Kevin, the Chinese have been playing hardball with Canadian nationals, obviously with the very clear purpose of trying to spring Ms. Wang. And I'm trying to sort of figure this out. Do you think that they will honor the request to extradite her to the United States?
I don't know, but the fact that that they've continued to hold her and not cave to the pressure suggests that we actually have quite a bit of information already, and it's very damning against what Huawei's doing.
And again, just to tie this back to the concern, as you mentioned, that we've been studying a bit, Huawei is a central player in the Chinese digital infrastructure, as some have called it, that is being built out worldwide. I saw a map recently of the world that looks as though it either has already succumbed to the Chinese efforts to secure sort of the pole position, if you will, on 5G network building in countries literally all over the planet, or that has already had some success in beginning negotiations towards a memorandum of understanding with many countries that would give them that right. It's an ominous sign, Kevin. I don't know if you've seen this map as well, but it certainly suggests that the Chinese, and Huawei specifically, to some extent, they're I think of it as the mini-me, ZTE, are stealing a march on us. So these are developments that have extraordinarily high stakes.
This is a global economic war. Made in China 2025 does not happen without Huawei. And at least the Trump administration has recognized that and pushed for, you know, small action on this. But as you point out, the long-term implications are enormous. If China wins the 5G race and dominates technology at the next level, it would be as if they'd invented the computer. And a lot of American hegemony today exists because we were the pioneers in inventing the computer and commercializing it. And if they capture 5G, we're in deep trouble.
Well, and as you say, it becomes the vehicle from which they will be able to extract proprietary information, state secrets, enormous amounts of data about individuals, even, it's said, controlling the Internet of Things, which can have real security implications as well as a lot of potential inconvenience. Kevin, let me switch gears because against this backdrop and that we were talking about earlier in the program with Rick Fisher in terms of the Chinese military buildup, I did want to ask you about this speech that Chinese President Xi Jinping made recently to top leaders of his country, in which he warned that the country was facing what he called major risks, and that those risks arise from politics and ideology and include things like the economy, the environment, and the so-called external situation. What did you make of this, some might call it a cri de coeur on the part of the Chinese president?
Well, it's an admission of the very sad circumstances in which China finds themselves. They've gotten to where they are by intellectual property theft in large cases and sacrifice of our technology to them. But they cannot continue to grow at the pace that they've grown. The law of large numbers prevents a country from growing at 12% per year when it's the second largest, if not the largest, economy in the world. It just doesn't happen. So they've reported growth in the 6%, 6 to 7% range recently, which is a tremendous slowdown for them. And it's probably overhyped because the numbers are probably much worse than that. So they can't, unless they grow, they can't fulfill their promise to their peasant citizens. And if they continue to grow at the same pace that they've been doing it, they'll have to do it through a lot of nefarious means. And at the same time, they're developing, you know, this huge pollution problem as a result of their growth because they're not paying for that growth as they're moving forward and taking care of the environment and so forth. So they're in quite a quandary. And the sad thing and the scary thing is that will make them more militaristic. They will need to expand their territory and consume from other places. And that's a threat to the world.
Well, it is, especially, again, given what Rick is talking about in terms of the immense buildup that the Chinese have been undertaking. As you know, Kevin Freeman, you've studied this closely at the Economic War Room, but also the degree to which they're complementing sort of classic military capabilities with asymmetric ones. Of course, the whole economic warfare portfolio that you cover so well. But, you know, the Earth-Moon system and other activities in space, it's a very, very ominous picture. And I think it's time that we redouble our efforts to both understand what the Chinese are up to and to counter it. And I'm anticipating we'll have an important announcement about that to share with our audience here shortly as to what we hope to help the Trump administration do about it. We'll be back with you on that topic and much more. Kevin Freeman, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today for the splendid work you're doing now at Blaze TV with Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Come back to us again next week.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the very high privilege of being each week, by Diana West. By my lights, one of the country's great thinkers, writers, commentators, pundits on matters involving the intersection, really, of culture and the national psychology with the national security. And I am always delighted to talk with her about topics she's focusing on, many of which have important antecedents in her analyses in her two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can also find her writings these days at dinawest.net and often at the Daily Caller and such outlets. But we're particularly appreciative that she is a regular feature of our program here at Secure Freedom Radio. Diana West, welcome back.
Thank you. Wonderful to be back.
So, Diana, we have begun the final process of preparing, with your very considerable help, a sort of, well, I guess, somewhat elaborated version of some of the writings that you've been doing in recent months under the rubric of something you've called the red thread that stitches together what the hard left, the red, the communists, if you will, certainly socialists are up to as it has related to taking down the Trump presidency and before that the Trump candidacy. Give us just a foretaste of what's coming in a new monograph that will be shortly published along these lines by the Center for Security Policy Press.
Yes, well, I'm very excited about this publication. It includes some of the earlier work, but a great deal of new research as well. And I think that the title should suggest a thread of continuity with the past, because it's very important to knit all of this together with what has come before, because we cannot understand the seriousness of this until we understand this is a long march, this is a long process. And so the thread itself is a continuity with the communist movement going back a century at least, but certainly in this country. And the redness, as you suggest, does have to do with communism and Marxism. These same ideas, the same agenda that has been used to take us down again over this past century. We are led to believe by our fearless media, our completely horrible media, that everything having to do with Russian influence and subversion started in 2016 with the advent of Donald Trump. This in itself is an information operation against the truth, as we've discussed on numerous occasions. But flipping that, understanding that, does require a serious examination of the past and bringing it to the future. So what the red thread tries to do, it's sort of a thought experiment that looks at these central conspirators, these core planners of this takedown of the candidacy of Donald Trump and then the presidency of Donald Trump, who are still active and still very dangerous, and tries to, in a sense, embark on an intellectual history of their own ideological drivers, of their own pedigrees, which is in many cases available in open sources. You can look into the beliefs and writings of many of these central players and a lot of their activities over their careers. And so, in other words, if we are led to believe that John Brennan is the generic director of the CIA or James Comey, the director of the FBI, these become almost stock figures. And until you tease out what they believe in, we know John Brennan, for example, voted for Gus Hall in 1976. Who else did he believe in? What else was he writing? What was he believing? We can go back to some of their papers, some of their statements, and start to stitch together a more comprehensive ideological portrait of these people. And we find out that they all hew to the far left. These are not just public servants acting out. These are ideologically fanatical people. And I think that is why we can explain their behavior, which is so extreme and so outside the bounds of normal politics.
Yeah. And so devastating to our polity, really, when you think about what has been done. And you know, Diana, to put a fine point on this, John Solomon at The Hill has just in the past day unloaded a whole new roster of documents and evidence that this red thread, as you call it, involved, among other things, Hillary Clinton's political machine and her campaign apparatus, for that matter, having been very closely involved in disseminating to the FBI Russian disinformation and the like. This isn't a surprise to you, needless to say, but it is shocking nonetheless.
Well, it's shocking. It's almost a different way of just kind of shaking up the same balls and re-spreading them out. We've been focused on, you know, very minutely on the passage of the Steele dossier around backdoor Washington. And of course, the sort of central control is the Clinton campaign, is all of the people around the Clinton campaign. And that's where you can start building out these networks. But remember who Hillary Clinton is. If we go back to her biography, it was Barbara Olson, the late Barbara Olson, who many years ago looked into Hillary Clinton's upbringing and found that as a youngster in her Methodist church, there was a youth minister there who was essentially spreading a Marxist gospel that was based in a theology propagated by a member of the Frankfurt School named Tillich. I mean, this becomes very important. She was reading Tillich as a youngster.
So this is even before she became a devotee of Saul Alinsky.
Before Saul Alinsky. She moved on. Yes, she would progress to Saul Alinsky, but if we actually knit that together with a James Comey, James Comey was taught at William & Mary by a student of Tillich. I mean, we're looking at the Frankfurt School weaponized, essentially, and we have to start understanding this.
And remind our audience of who the Frankfurt School was or what it was and the role that it played in this red subversion in our country.
Yes, well, the Frankfurt School was a famously Marxist school in the 1920s in Germany, and many of the professors attached to this school became refugees after Hitler came to power, either as communists or Jews or both, and many of them were brought to this country, really hundreds of them, were brought to this country where they essentially set out or spread out onto the college campuses of America and began teaching what many people describe as cultural Marxism. They're essentially different ways of teaching Marxism in academia through the institutions. This was a very important point. I will add that the group, the institute that was able to save these refugees who were in Hitler times, was actually headed by a man named Stephen Duggan, whose son, Lawrence Duggan, a State Department official, was later unmasked as a Soviet agent. We also have several agents, people associated with the NKVD and, you know, the Secret Service of Stalin's Russia, who were actually associated with the Frankfurt School. I mean, this is a very serious thing. They're Marxists, but they also were agents, some of them, a handful of them, very prominently so. So we're looking at the weaponization of an ideological takedown of this country that filters out into people like Hillary Clinton or James Comey and others through their teachings, through what they believe. What they believe becomes very important to us because it's anti-constitutional and anti-American, and that is where we have to go and study and learn to understand why these people could go into these incredibly anti-constitutional and even lawless, take these lawless measures in this anti-Trump conspiracy that we are painstakingly trying to unmask.
Yeah. Well, you are. I'm not sure we are. Certainly, the Congress hasn't been, as far as I can tell, with the possible exception of Devin Nunes over the years. And Diana West, what you really have pointed to is this is the sort of thing that demands investigation, and we're very much looking forward to the red thread, this compilation of your essays on the subject and some expanded works as well that would inform an honest investigation, and it ought to be our purpose, I think, in this new year. Let's make a New Year's resolution to get that investigation, which is long overdue, much needed, into the not only the real collusion that has taken place with the Russians over the years, the documentable collusion, but also the degree to which we have people who are very much in the mold of the Frankfurt School and the sort of agents of yore that the Soviets and Russians have been running against this country are still doing in terms of subverting our nation and polity. Diana, we have to leave it at that for the moment, though. This is great work, and we look forward to the Red Threads publication in the near future. We'll be talking about it more in the days ahead, I know. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.